the Allstate Skyline Studio.
WGN Radio presents a conversation.
I want to make one thing perfectly clear.
A dialogue.
What are you prepared to do?
An astute debate.
Everything that's in the law.
And a peek behind the curtain of politics.
And then what are you prepared to do?
I think Chicago is not only the center of the country, I think it's the center of the world.
Don't tread on them.
Where did this statement come from?
This is the Sunday Spin. Your host is the Chicago Tribune's Rick Pearson.
Good Sunday morning, everyone. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune, and welcome to this edition of the Sunday Spin for May the 12th, 2019. A very happy Mother's Day to everyone. This is our weekly look at the world of politics and policy, taking you from City Hall to the State House and all the way up to the White House. So, time to grab that Sunday paper, get that hot cup of coffee, and we'll do our best to get your week off to a great start. Well, I still have the winter jacket out. I mean, happy Mother's Day.
November in May.
Oh, it is pathetic.
That's a good word for it, yeah.
I mean, I felt...
I've used much stronger language in the past week.
No, not you. Not you. Not Dave Schwann.
I wasn't Sunshine Schwanny for
really?
Whole week.
No, it's... I want spring, you know, and I have a feeling all of a sudden it's going to be like a light switch. And I mean, look at the temperatures for later in the week.
I was just going to say, you're not far wrong. I'm looking at Tom Skilling's forecast for the week. Wednesday in the 65 to 70 degree range for a high. Thursday, 70 once again. Next Saturday, the upper 70s, and I've even seen reports, maybe, just maybe, 80 for next Saturday and or Sunday.
Want to bet?
No. In this instance, I'm not a betting man.
Well, I was down in Springfield for the latter part of last week, and when I got down on Wednesday afternoon, it was 79 degrees down there. But... It looked just like it does here outside. I mean, it was gray, overcast.
Was it raining?
It eventually turned to rain, but it was that kind of nice humidity you get that I hate the humidity, but it felt so good after what we've been going through.
Yeah.
And then on Friday, when I left Springfield, it was like this, you know, 50, 40s. It's just... I just want to turn the page here a little bit.
Yeah.
But
well, like I say, hang in. We've got a few more days. Let's hope this holds true. 70, maybe 80 next weekend.
Well, I guess when you think of Mother's Day and you think of flowers,
oh,
this
absolutely.
Is probably good planting.
Yes, and I remember
weather.
Mother's Day's years ago, and we would be out cutting flowers off our lilac bush in the backyard.
Right.
It's not this year.
Well, and I felt sorry for those folks sitting at Wrigley yesterday in that kind of moisture.
I would think the diehard fans that stayed there, and they dedicated fans they were, will tell you that it was worth it with that walk-off home run in the 15th inning to win the game.
Especially against the Brew Crew.
Mm-hmm.
And we're back in first place by a game.
Right.
And it was great to see Contreras come through. They had their chances several times in that game. But the Bodie slide, I guess we'll call it, in the fifth inning. I mean, a great play, scoring from first base. And on a ball that didn't even make it all the way to the wall. I think it caught the Brewers by surprise.
Good anticipation, good read.
Yeah. So, a nice win by the White Sox.
Yeah, how about this James McCann character who the White Sox acquired from Detroit? You know, to be a nice receiver, you know, good guy that could be good in the clubhouse and would be more of a defensive guy. He's hitting .376.
Not bad. You like when those signings work out just right.
Yeah, a really good guy too, and has been calling great games. Yesterday he got a lot of credit for Ivan Nova's second straight win, and in the process went 4-for-5.
Not bad.
No big deal.
Not too shabby.
Mm-hmm.
And we've got more Sox baseball today, pregame at 11:30.
That is true. And then you know, in Toronto they do a strange start time.
Yeah,
it's always 07.
Huh. Why?
Because they do two national anthems.
Oh, good point.
How about that? I found that out yesterday.
Very good. Good point.
Because I was wondering why as well, and then I'm like, well, someone told me.
That answers my question, too.
Yeah. Yeah, somebody out there said it was because they do two anthems.
Makes sense, just like the NHL with the Canadian team. And I have been watching those playoffs, and
I have
to tell you, Boston and San Jose, two strong opening games for the conference finals.
Yeah, I agree.
I mean, you shouldn't read too much into one game, I know, but the Bruins and San Jose look like they're destined to meet for the cup.
Yeah, I wouldn't mind seeing it. Wouldn't mind seeing it. Carolina, San Jose.
I would not either. I'm not.
As long as the Blues aren't there, I'm good.
But Brad Marchand is enough to.
Yeah, not want them in there at all.
I consider him one of the most detestable pro athletes that I know of. And
he seems to get a sick enjoyment of it, doesn't he?
That's the thing. You know, great skills.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Great skills. But to make up for it is just acting like a jerk.
Yeah. And, you know, he's doing his job because he's getting under other players' skin and trying to make them, you know, off their game a little bit, commit penalties and take penalties and put the Bruins in a power play situation. But, yeah, he is. He's one of those guys that. I'm not even sure if he was on your team you'd like.
I don't think so. I mean, you think there would be a respect factor, and I'm not sure even in the locker room there's a respect for him.
Yeah, he's been around a long time, though, and it's his act has worked. Let's put it to you that way.
His act has worked, but it's wearing very thin these days.
That's very true.
The Bears finally get a field goal kicker?
Well, we'll see.
Well, so what? They tried out eight guys,
yeah,
and they didn't make the cut.
No, I felt bad for the one guy. Everybody seemed to like this kid too, and I can't remember his name off the top of my head. But he kicked the 43-yard field goal and then did a backflip.
Right,
and I don't think that really endeared him to the Matt Nagy style of.
Dude, you know, getting the job done.
Yeah, it's not about you. It's about us. I think he was upset. You know, obviously with the whole situation with Cody Parkey last year,
right.
Going on the
on the Today Show, right.
Yeah, and you know, going ahead and doing that. But you know, I don't know. But the kid they picked up is Eddie Pinheiro, and he was a kicker for the Raiders last year because he had to fill in for Sebastian Janikowski.
Well, I think anything's better than Cody Park.
Yeah, you know, and I'd been saying it too. Even with the eight kickers in camp, I still didn't feel like the opening day kicker was in camp yet.
Right.
And you know, he still may not be, but this is a step in the right direction. He only kicked three field goals last year for Oakland, but he made them all 21, 48, and 45 yards.
All right, I like that 48.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So he's got some leg and. And has had game situation.
He was the most accurate field goal kicker in Florida history. Kicked for the Gators for 4 years.
Well, let's see what happens. Let's see what happens.
Yeah, can't be. Well, as I don't want to say that, but
well,
you're right. You never know because you know at least Double Doink's not here, and we can figure out what's going on from there.
Let's be optimistic.
Yeah,
let's be optimistic. That's the word of the day.
Optimism in year 100 of the NFL.
Exactly. Well, Dave's here to keep us up to date on all the news. Andy has the latest sports. Producer Cassara is fielding your calls. We're at 312-981-7200. Our text line is also 312-981-7200. We're on Facebook at facebook.com/thesundayspin, all one word. We're on Twitter at @SundaySpin. Engineer Bob is looking for the Mother's Day brunch fixings. Remember, you can find all of our shows on WGNRadio.com. You can also get our podcasts at iTunes by searching for my name, Rick Pearson. We're going to take a quick break. You're listening to The Sunday Spin on WGN. Good Sunday morning. Happy Mother's Day. Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune. Up ahead on the show, after the 7:30 news and sports, we'll talk to Democratic State Representative Ann Williams of Chicago. We'll talk to her about the Clean Energy Jobs Act, where it stands, and what it would mean for Illinois. After the 8 o'clock update of the news and sports, we'll speak to Democratic State Representative Sarah Feigenholz. We'll talk to her about new child care initiatives as well as additional problems that have been uncovered at the Department of Children and Family Services. We'll get a final check of the news and sports at 8:30, and then we'll speak to David Harris. The former Republican lawmaker is now director of the Illinois Department of Revenue. We'll talk to him about the recent April surprise in funding receipts that increased state funds last month. And we'll also talk to him about Governor J.B. Pritzker's push for a graduated rate income tax. That's all up ahead. But now it's time to launch our weekly spin through national politics. And, of course, another interesting week in Washington. President Trump and China facing a breakdown in trade talks. That prompted the imposition of tariffs, continued problems facing the nation's farmers, Illinois farmers, soybean stocks pile up, hog prices down. That's just on the trade side. Then we go to Capitol Hill, where Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell called on Democrats to basically get over the Mueller report and move forward in dealing with the nation's problems.
This investigation went on for 2 years. It's finally over. Many Americans were waiting to see how their elected officials would respond. With an exhaustive investigation complete, would the country finally unify to confront the real challenges before us? Would we finally be able to move on from partisan paralysis and breathless conspiracy theorizing? Or would we remain consumed by unhinged partisanship and keep dividing ourselves to the point that Putin and his agents need only stand on the sidelines and watch us as their job is actually done for them? Regrettably, the answer is pretty obvious.
But Illinois Senior Senator Dick Durbin, the number two ranking Democrat in the Senate, says Republicans are trying to bury very concerning findings in the Mueller report.
It's pretty clear that the Republican leader would like to say to the American people, keep on moving, there's nothing to be seen here, but we know better. If you take a look at the Mueller report, $26 million spent, 50 attorneys, almost 2 years, scores of indictments that came down and some guilty pleas already, and yet even more to follow. This isn't over, and it won't be over soon, nor should it be. It is obvious that my Republican colleagues want to move on as quickly as possible from talking about how Russia interfered in the 2016 election with the stated intent of helping to elect Donald Trump president.
That's Illinois Democratic Senior Senator Dick Durbin. You're listening to The Sunday Spin on WGN.
Now back to the Tribune's Rick Pearson. It's The Sunday Spin on 720 WGN.
Good Sunday morning. Welcome back to The Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune. You earlier heard from Mitch McConnell, the U.S. Senate Republican leader, about his views involving the Mueller report and saying that Democrats need to move on. Well, Chuck Schumer, the New Yorker who leads up the minority Democrats in the Senate, he likened Mitch McConnell's efforts to say it's time to move on. He likened them to Richard Nixon.
So our leader says, let's move on. It's sort of like Richard Nixon saying, let's move on at the height of the investigation of his wrongdoing. Of course, he wants to move on. He wants to cover up. He wants to silence on one of the most serious issues we face. Whether a foreign power can manipulate our elections, the wellspring of our democracy. If the leader is sincere, then put election security on the floor. Let's debate it. Put sanctions on Russia on the floor. Let's debate it. He doesn't want to move on. He wants to run away.
That's Senate Democratic Leader Chuck Schumer of New York. Well, we're going to bring things much more local now. We're speaking here in the Allstate Skyline studio to Ann Williams, Democratic State Representative from Chicago. Representative, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Good morning, Rick. Thanks for having me.
So you are the sponsor of what's known as the Clean Energy Jobs Act, and a legislation that's gotten bipartisan support. I think dozens of sponsors in both sides, both chambers.
Yeah.
Give us the breakdown. What is this legislation?
Well, this bill is a very comprehensive and extensive policy, which will move Illinois forward when it comes to clean energy and the development of renewable energy sources. The bill has about four, well, I'll call them pillars. First, there's a goal of reducing carbon from the power sector by 2030. Eliminating carbon from the power sector. By 2050, we're shooting for 100% renewable energy. We also provide for the electrification of the transportation sector, focusing on fleet vehicles, municipal pool vehicles, etc. And our goal is to reduce the equivalent of 1 million gas and diesel-powered vehicles from the road. And our final piece is all about equity. And this simply provides that communities who have been disproportionately impacted by pollution, by whether it's in the downstate areas, coal ash, etc., or in the more urban areas that have been impacted by industrial pollution. Those are the communities we want to ensure has a share as we move forward with this new, exciting green economy. We want to make sure all Illinoisans can play a part in it.
I think nationally, you know, when you look at the, you hear legislators talking about, you know, green, and the pushback that it's gotten, that the kind of the modernization of our energy supply is getting caught into partisan politics, where the evolution toward a green energy sector and the potential benefit of the jobs created with it get lost in the sidelines.
Absolutely. If you hear some of the rhetoric out of the Trump administration, that underscores your point. Some of the tangible actions that Trump has taken lately are really quite stunning and show a stunning disregard for the future of our planet. This includes everything from pulling out of the Paris Climate Accord to the recent scaling back of EPA criminal enforcement actions. We're at the lowest point that we've ever been in terms of EPA criminal enforcement for polluters. It's been more than 30 years since we've seen this low level of enforcement. If anything, we should be increasing our enforcement, you know, 2, 3, 4, 5 fold. And, you know, there's a list of examples. You've, I'm sure, read articles about the danger that so many new species and the saltwater fish are facing. You know, I read these articles and I hope, you know, I look quickly at the source, see them on Facebook or something, and hope that it's some crazy blog with no basis in reality or science, but it's on being reported by NPR and CNN and MSNBC. This is real and it's happening, and it's happening faster than I think any of us anticipated.
So with this act, we talk about clean jobs. I mean, is part of it because of putting these mandates for changing over to the greener economy that the jobs follow?
Well, yes, and there's more than just mandates. We're just, you know, we're using
I'm
incentives.
Sorry, Springfield mandates, yeah, a dirty word. I apologize.
There's, you know, I think it's a real mix. The bill is 500 pages. It's got a lot in there. But what we're talking about in terms of jobs is already happening in Illinois. A few years ago, you may recall, we passed the Future Energy Jobs Act, and that was a compilation of items that bolstered renewable energy development, as well as a number of other items pertaining to energy. It was supported by an array of energy producers as well as environmentalists. So we were on board with the bill. The renewable community was on board with the bill because of the great benefits it could provide for the increase in green jobs. And in fact, that has worked. It's actually worked too well, because we have the demand we have for the development of solar, for example, is greatly exceeds the ability of the state to facilitate these solar energy projects. That's one of the reasons we wanted to move forward with the Clean Energy Jobs Act. The demand is there. The companies are there willing to invest in Illinois, wanting to invest in Illinois, but the infrastructure simply isn't in place to allow the development to occur. So that's one of the kind of of overriding goals of this piece of legislation.
What do you mean by the infrastructure isn't there?
Well, for example, in the FEJA, which is the Future Energy Jobs Act, we provided for additional opportunities for solar developers. There was such interest in developing solar projects around the state that the Illinois Power Agency could only provide for, I think, 1 out of 8 projects. So we ended up in a lottery, if you will. So that means there are developers out there, large-scale developers that have projects nationwide that are ready and willing to develop in Illinois, but we need to make sure that we have the ability and the capacity to procure and allow that power to be developed. What we do in this current bill is a bit of a different approach. We address capacity by allowing Illinois to create its own capacity market for clean energy specifically. What happened is the federal level, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, provided for an opportunity to create capacity in each state. But the way their rules are structured, and certainly by design, they greatly favor fossil fuels. You can imagine why that might be. But the good news is, they allow Illinois and every other state to develop its own market. And what we would like to do in Illinois through the Clean Energy Jobs Act is to ensure that the rules in place in Illinois for the procurement of power incentivize clean energy. And that includes renewables, solar, wind, and nuclear is also considered clean.
And I want to ask you about nuclear because Illinois is somewhat unique in the fact that it derives so much of its energy source from nuclear power. Where does that fit into this picture?
Well, I think you've been around Springfield long enough to know that these big comprehensive pieces of legislation in the energy world often require cooperation from both the generators, the energy distributors, and the environmental community. So this legislation will likely be something that we will all have to work on collaboratively. So energy, both fossil fuel plants and nuclear plants, the plants have limited shelf lives. Coal plants, I think even the coal producers and the CEOs of the big coal companies are using terms like inevitable to describe the way that the coal plants will be eventually being closed down. That's just the way it is. The plants have limited life. People are not building new coal plants for obvious reasons. They're inefficient to run. They're expensive to run. They're big polluters. And, you know, even the companies recognize those items. But what we do in the Clean Energy Jobs Act, both with nuclear and with coal plants over time, is instead of having these plants just close willy-nilly, leaving devastation in the communities they abruptly, you know, leave, we are planning and looking at energy and the production of energy in a long-term manner. So this will help the communities plan and prepare for the closure of these plants. And in exchange, there will be opportunities in the clean energy sector, training programming, which is already happening in the wake of the FEJA Act, Future Energy Jobs Act, to create these jobs in the communities where they have been negatively impacted. So for downstate, that's former coal communities where, you know, the coal mine was the main employer in town.
Don't we remember? Yeah. And as well as, big union jobs too, which at good salaries, and the phasing out of that has already, you know, hurt so much of rural Illinois.
I think, you know, those entities, as well as labor, organized labor, as well as environmentalists, there's a really unique coalition here that can get back the development of renewable energy. Those wind farms, the solar farms, they take a lot of people power to build and to maintain. So it's not just kind of a one-off. You get some, you know, great opportunities to build. These plants can produce, you know, really thousands of jobs. And in fact, since the Future Energy Jobs Act was passed, we have become the second highest state in terms of growth of solar jobs in the whole country. So that's a real high number for Illinois and really for any state.
A high number and a good number for once.
We'll take
about
it.
Illinois.
Yeah.
We're speaking with Democratic State Representative Ann Williams from Chicago about the Clean Energy Jobs Act. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. . 7:51 on this Mother's Day Sunday morning. I'm Rick Pearson here in the Allstate Skyline Studio, joined by Democratic State Representative Ann Williams of Chicago. She is a sponsor of the Clean Energy Jobs Act. We've been talking about these efforts, which are supported on Republicans, Democrats in the legislature, bill to modernize our delivery of energy in this state. I want to ask you, there's been a kind of a kerfuffle in the news. We've talked a lot in this program about capital infrastructure and the need for an infrastructure bill, as well as the fact that, yeah, there's going to be some things like a gas tax increase likely, license plate fee increase likely. It's for transportation projects, it is like a user fee. But in one of the latest iterations of a bill to pay for roads and bridges and transportation projects is a proposal to raise the incentivized fee for all-electric vehicles to $1,000 a year for a license plate. Obviously, I think there is a desire to try to capture some of the user fee experience for people that pay gas taxes and have gasoline-operated vehicles. But at the same time, $1,000 a year for a license plate at a time when all of the efforts have been to incentivize people to move to hybrids or to all-electric, that's a big chunk of change.
Yeah, that's pretty pricey. And I'm concerned. I see where the senator's going here, what his goal is, but I'm concerned about disincentivizing people to go to electric. We are doing everything we can in the Clean Energy Jobs Act to incentivize people, and not just people that have the means to purchase a $60,000-$70,000 electric car. We are looking to utilize, EV access for all is one of the programs that we have in this bill, and that would mean that people in all communities can access the opportunity to utilize electric vehicles instead of, what did they used to have? Those cars that you would go Spot Hero.
Pick up drop off.
Yeah, those type of cars. Why not put those in communities, low income electrical vehicle car sharing opportunities? Those are things that we're looking at. We want to make sure, and that's a central theme of this bill, is to make sure that all communities, all people in Illinois, all income levels can share in participating in this green economy. So this comes, out when we're talking about job training, but it also applies to the electric vehicle. We would like more people to acquire personal electric vehicles, too. And that $1,000 price tag is pretty, pretty scary.
$1,000 a year.
A year. A year. That deters my plans to get that dream Tesla.
Well,
postpone that a little bit longer.
And there are some people that say, well, if you can afford a Tesla, well, then what's $1,000 a year?
Well, we're hoping that the car, and we know the car manufacturers are looking at lower cost options to get more people into electric cars. I think part of the challenge, and this is a theme that we've noticed when lobbying legislators, is to just get comfortable of the idea we are going in the direction of electric vehicles. That's happening. And it's not just because we think it's a great idea and it's good for the planet. While that might be enough to get me to purchase an electric vehicle, it also is better for business. Their cars are efficient. They're just the wave of the future. And the same goes with renewable energy sources. Companies are opting to utilize renewable energy sources and put them on their rooftops and tap into energy efficiency programs, not because they are driven by the concern about climate change, although in some cases they are, they're driven by cost efficiency. The reality is solar and wind requires initial investment, like any energy generation tool. But over time, they are much less expensive to run, and energy then is much less expensive to produce.
Well, it's kind of like the recapture. There might be that initial outlay, but once you've done that, then it's a matter that you recapture the savings.
Exactly.
From these kind of thing.
And if we're able to reduce capacity through energy efficiency and utilizing sources of energy that require less energy in the long run, we're going to save money too. So that's one component of the bill we haven't discussed, but that's an important theme too, is the initial investment is there, But once we get there, in the long run, this is good. We save power, we save money, and we save the planet in the process.
Is there a mass transit component to this?
Part of the electrification piece does impact mass transit, and we're hopeful that the fleets will go with cleaner fuel options and eventually go electric. And we're already seeing that happening, again, for the same reasons we've discussed. These are more fuel efficient. These are cheaper to run. The maintenance is not as difficult. And I think a lot of times, you know, governments, they want to be able to answer to constituents' concerns about climate change and carbon emissions. And this is one good way to do it.
Well, I mean, and going back to the license plate thing, too, and we're talking about Tesla, but you've got Rivian, which is located in Bloomington. Normal took over the old Mitsubishi plant there, which is gaining an investment from other automobile manufacturers. They're looking at electric truck production. You look at $1,000, and I don't know that that's really a good sign to show a new and growing kind of upstart company. This is what Illinois thinks of you.
Yeah, I'd rather work on some of the incentives. I think it's where we need to go. Of course, we need the generation to be cleaner than it is now. But I think when taken in tandem as a full package, we're really going in the right direction here.
So I talked about capital. Obviously, that's one of the several unsettled components going on in Springfield as we get closer to the May 31st scheduled adjournment date. I think I'm going to be emphasizing that word scheduled. Because after being
don't say that. Please.
Well, after being
I plan on coming home on June 1st.
I understand, and that may well be. It might be a matter of when you go back.
Sure.
As you well know, but I just get the sense that things are just greatly unsettled right now in Springfield.
I think you're right. There are a lot of very big, very important topics that are still being bantered around, and for anyone in the real world, 3 weeks doesn't seem like a lot of time, but in Springfield time, deadlines have a way of incentivizing people to make decisions and take positions. 3 weeks out, a lot of us are weighing options, considering alternatives, but every day that goes by that we get closer to adjournment, I think people begin to solidify on these issues, whether it's on updating the antiquated tax system with a graduated tax situation. Cannabis, of course, is a hot topic. Capital, and then, you know, we have some sports betting conversation and, you know, how to increase revenues there. And then, of course, I'd put clean jobs at the top of the list.
Understood. Understood. Democratic State Representative Ann Williams of Chicago, thank you so much for joining me this
morning.
Thank
you for having me.
This is the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN. Once again, here's Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune.
Good Sunday morning and welcome to the second hour of your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune. Impeachment remains a concern among leading Democrats in the United States House of Representatives. Democrats in control of the House, that's where proceedings would start. But with Republicans controlling the Senate, Trump's removal from office is all but impossible. Still, Democratic House Speaker Nancy Pelosi is dealing with some Democrats, such as calls from Elizabeth Warren in the Senate to impeach Trump. But Democratic Speaker Nancy Pelosi says that Trump wants Democrats to actually try to remove him.
Trump is goading us to impeach him. That's what he's doing. Every single day, he's just like taunting, because he knows that it would be very divisive in the country, but he doesn't really care. Just wants to solidify his base. That might have been too political, so, you know, criticize me for that. But that's what it is. So we can't impeach him for political reasons, and we can't not impeach him for political reasons. But we have to see where the facts take us.
That's Democratic House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. We're going to bring things back to Illinois now, and joining me here in the Allstate Skyline studio is Democratic State Representative Sarah Feigenholz from Chicago. Representative, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
It's great to be here, Rick. Thanks for having me.
You are the chairwoman of a House Committee on adoption and Child Welfare.
Right.
And obviously, a lot of issues involving child welfare, unfortunately, in the news lately, particularly, obviously, the death of five-year-old Andrew A.J. Freund from Crystal Lake
getting attention and putting a renewed focus on the Department of Children and Family Services.
Yeah, this has been something I've been thinking about doing for a long time, and I've talked to many people who have an interest in child welfare. You know, we have so many health care related issues facing us in the General Assembly that child welfare seems to fall to the bottom of the priority list. And I've felt for years that, you know, we really need to address this agency because, you know, this is an agency that has had, I believe, 13 directors in maybe the last 15 years. So the turnover, the lack of leadership, the lack of vision and focus and mission of child protection has eroded. And we're seeing that not just, you know, A.J. Freund was a tragic, tragic mistake. And there are a lot of other cases very similar to his statewide that we in the committee have reviewed the timelines of these tragedies and seen a sort of a pattern of where things may have gone awry. And it is our charge in this committee to address those issues and work with the new director, Mark Smith, who is a very calming force, which is a good thing, who has spent his life in child welfare. He began his career in child welfare at DCFS as a caseworker when Jess McDonald was the director. And the first time I met him, I said to him, "You didn't create this, but you have inherited it." And, you know, I think what we're going to be doing, you know, after looking at these cases, I believe that the governor is very concerned about this, and I am glad that it is getting his attention. We're going to be looking at some recommendations. The governor asked Chapin Hall, which is a child welfare foundation or think tank here at U of C, I believe, that is going to make some recommendations. I believe those recommendations will come out relatively soon, if not this week. And we're going to see, hopefully, a focus on the Intact Family Program, which is a program to keep kids in their home with their parents. And most of the children were either that we're reading about who have had these tragic deaths have either been in unfounded cases and kept in homes with their families. Somehow, hotline calls were not deemed serious enough. And we're going to look at, and also the children that were, had been in foster care, and look at all of the elements as far back as we can go. And in many ways, kind of, you know, try and collect enough data, Rick, that we can focus in on what we have to do, especially when it comes to the Intact Family Program.
We're speaking with Democratic State Representative Sarah Feigenholz of Chicago about child welfare issues. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson. Just want to give a special happy Mother's Day shout out to a longtime listener, Barbara Walsh. Thank you so much for listening. Happy Mother's Day. Hope you're having a great day. We're speaking here in studio with Sarah Feigenholz, Democratic State Representative from Chicago. We're talking about child welfare issues. And, you know, Representative, you went through the litany of directors that this agency has had. I mean, just why does anything ever get better there? I know that's such an all-encompassing, but I mean, is it wrong for me to think
No, I mean, I think it's a legitimate question. And I also think that sitting through the hearings and reading the news accounts of the A.J. Freund case has really woken up the public about how troubled this agency is. It's unfortunate that it had to get so bad, but I'm going to be optimistic, Rick, and I'm going to say that because we have this committee and new leadership, and we have a governor who is committed, that there is going to be an aggressive push to improve this agency and the welfare of children. I know that I'm going to be as noisy as possible, and you know that's pretty noisy, until we get this right.
You said earlier about in committee going through some of these cases, you went through timelines and you found a pattern. What do you mean by that? What is the pattern?
You know, when some of the decisions were made to leave children intact, or at home under some pretty difficult circumstances, we began to ask ourselves about how these decisions were made and who above the investigators were reviewing these cases. It seemed like what it all boils down to is what we have to do is we have to put more caseworkers in the front lines because we are overburdening and stressing out and burning out our investigators. That's one. The governor has, in his budget address, said he's going to be putting 126 frontline workers into the field. I believe he's already up to 100. So he's fulfilling that promise. He's probably also looking at maybe more, because the whole administration and the whole infrastructure of DCFS has been stripped out because of the budget impasse. And I believe that there's not a lot of vertical accountability in the agency. And I'm sure that as the director who began April 15th, by the way,
right,
not even a month, tomorrow's the month that he's been on the job, is looking at his org chart and saying, we have got, you know, and he's looking at this system. And, you know, a lot of people in his position would say, I'm amazed that we're doing as well as we are, you know? So there are other elements of, you know, I mean, if you talk to a caseworker, Rick, they'll tell you that, you know, the ratios on their cases is what is hugely problematic, that they don't really have the tools that they need to do their job. There's a lot more technology, a lot more training for these frontline workers who are what I would consider first responders, you know.
Well, and I mean, obviously we had Auditor General Frank Martino did an audit of the agency, and, you know, and I realize that the budget impasse, you know, was devastating to social services across the board. But it always seems there's been that issue of the caseworkers having more cases than they can effectively manage. And sometimes caseworkers get the blame for missing something. But at the same time, when they have so many open cases that they have to review, the checkbacks they have to do, it's not manageable.
No, it's not. And I think what we're going to see from the Chapin Hall report, and I think that any member of this committee who's heard all these cases, and it's been very difficult to sit through them, and hear what has happened to these kids, it just will rip you apart. Is we're probably going to have to take a closer look at our intact family services and create a more robust service package. If we're going to keep children in the families of people struggling with a drug addiction, we have to look at the, you know, violence in the family, and we have to kind of take a snapshot of the history. And if we're going to keep these kids in these families, there are successful programs. Our service package around intact is not robust enough. This, I believe, is what puts these children at risk.
So, well, I mean, it is children and family services, this agency, and you know, in a wholesome kind of way.
Right. A lot of members on our committee, the debate is very interesting. We have some members on the committee who want to know why these children weren't removed from such a dangerous situation. And I think that that's a natural reaction. And then you have others who say, why didn't this family get services on substance abuse treatment? They're poor. They don't have a functioning car. They can't get their child to school, or, you know, there's like, you know, so what's going to happen if we don't solve this? I mean, we have to solve it because there's going to be there's great diversity in our caucuses about how to respond to this. And I, as you know, am a person who is a pretty strong believer in reunification, right? I was adopted, and I believe that, I believe in reunification. I think little children, you know, you heard little A.J. Freund when he was at the doctor, you know, when they asked him if somebody in his house heard him, and his little innocent voice says, yeah, I think my mommy, you know, may have hit me with a belt buckle.
Accidentally.
Right. I mean, but you know what? We're not going to change human nature. We have to change how we address these problems in a very smart way. And I think a lot of it is going to have to be an investment of dollars. The public should know that I looked into the number of cuts that this agency has suffered over the last maybe 13 years. And it turns out that DCFS was cut about $200 million. Cut.
And this is what you get.
Right. And so we're going to have to rebuild this agency.
Well, and you were talking off air, too, about pay for some of these.
You know, we have four regions in child welfare. DCFS is divided into four regions in the state. We have a hotline. We have, and then that information is disseminated to the field and to those regions. And then the investigators work for the state. But once there is a service plan or the need is assessed, very often, 85% of the time, this responsibility is handed off to our community organizations that are embedded, like Lutheran Social Services, Catholic Charities, you name it, and Children's Home and Aid. You know, and these cases are very complex, you know? And the workers in these agencies are making, I think Nancy Ronquillo said, $13.58 an hour. And haven't seen a rate increase in 12 years. So if we're going to enlist people to do a job of child and family services and welfare, we have got to raise the standard, the pay, to stabilize the workforce. And if we have an expectation of state-of-the-art training, wraparound services, it is incumbent upon us to fortify them and give them the tools they need to do their job.
That's Democratic State Representative Sarah Feigenholz from Chicago. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin.
Now back to the Tribune's Rick Pearson. It's the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN.
Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson, the Chicago Tribune, here in the Allstate Skyline studio. Joining me here in studio is David Harris, former Republican state representative from Arlington Heights, former adjutant general of the Illinois National Guard, and currently the director of the Illinois Department of Revenue. General, thank you so much for joining me.
Rick, good morning. Good to be with you.
First of all, Republican in a Democratic governor's administration, what's that like?
What's it like? It's absolutely great. I will tell you that the governor has often said he wants to work in a bipartisan manner. I served 18 years in the legislature. I was on the Revenue Committee for those 18 years. I was on Appropriations for 8 years, so I had an excellent understanding of tax policy as well as budgeting. The governor reached out in a bipartisan way and said, would you be willing to be the director of the Department of Revenue? I was delighted and pleased because I support his initiatives as well, and it's a great position, absolutely.
And it doesn't hurt to have that background in the General Assembly for a new governor.
Well, it helps with the relationships with legislators, no question.
I wanted to have you on for a couple of reasons, not the least of which is we just had the news of an April surprise and a boost of state revenues on a variety of, I guess, attributable to a variety of things, changes in the federal tax policy. Obviously, April is income tax receipts time, but in any event, $1.5 billion
dollars in revenue beyond expectations.
It was an incredible receipt month, no question about that, Rick.
I mean, what was it due to?
As you said, it was a multitude of factors. Certainly, the federal tax law had had an impact. To give you an example, back in at the end of 2017, I prepaid my first property tax bill, as did many individuals. If you remember the lines outside of Maria Pappas's office during December of 2017, because folks knew that they were not going to get that deduction at the federal level for 2018. So there was an impact there. The way our Medicaid system works, we get reimbursements from the federal government. Medicaid is a 50-50 right. program. We get reimbursements from the federal government. Those came in larger numbers. And then unemployment is at a 50-year low, meaning that more people are working. More people are working, generate tax revenues. So we had an enormous spike in April receipts, as you say, $1.4 billion.
So I kind of off the air said, I kind of view this as good news, bad news. The good news, certainly it's good news to get $1.5 billion more in revenue to the state, with given the financial issues the state faces, and the governor has decided to use that revenue to make the fully fund a pension payment rather than embark on a new kind of deferral policy with a new ramp to make those pension payments, which right. alleviates some headaches that he was facing with that concept. But at the same time, having been in Springfield the last couple of days, I get the feeling that it also takes some of the pressure off legislators to act on certain agenda items that the governor had proposed in his budget, like cannabis legislation and sports betting, along with various other technical means to make the budget work. I get this feeling that it gives the legislature an excuse not to have to do something.
Rick, I'll say you're right. It's probably somewhat of a double-edged sword. However, let's go back and remember what the governor has proposed in his budget. He has proposed a reasonable, balanced budget for the first time in many years, and it's not built on phony numbers. As an example, the previous three budgets under Governor Rauner put $300 million in the budget for the sale of the Thompson Center. That's yes. not in Governor Pritzker's budget. It is a budget based on reasonable numbers. And remember, the governor has said this. The governor has said he recognizes the financial problems and the financial difficulties that the state has and is in, and he wants to build a budget that is a bridge to financial stability. So we can't rely on one-time April surprises every year to get us through. We need to build a solid budget going into the future, and that's what the governor has done, both with his budget as well as his proposal for the fair tax.
But do lawmakers understand that? I mean, you've been there, and you know what I'm saying about that mentality of avoid at all costs.
Don't avoid taking the tough votes, certainly. And I completely understand. But I think there is a recognition, a real recognition, that we need to put our state on a more solid financial basis. That's what the governor has tried to do. He's looking long term. He wants to say, this is the direction I want to take the state in. And I will tell you, the governor has been very straightforward in this. He campaigned on it. He made it part of his inaugural speech, and he made it part of his budget address. So he's been very honest and open in terms of what he wants to do.
And I mean, for the most part, and it's not, I'm not just citing Rauner, go back Quinn, go back Blagojevich, go back. Long-term planning to achieve financial stability has never been a goal of anybody in this state.
Well, maybe we can make, hopefully the governor can change that. And I think he does. You know,
am I wrong?
I have to tell you, one of the reasons I'm really thrilled to be part of the Pritzker administration is because he thinks big. I mean, he thinks not just, okay, how do we get past this budget year, FY, coming up FY 20, but What happens in FY 21, 22 down the road? How can we put our state on a more solid basis? And that's what he wants to do.
So, well, then let me ask you, with this revenue that came in, obviously, and as I mentioned, it makes the pension payment. But, I mean, certainly you were aware of some of the grumbling that was being heard in the State House over, granted, it's his plan to achieve stability, but we all know how much pensions take up of the state budget and an increasing share as we pay the ramp on higher payments every year. But just that's still going to be the driver. And everybody asks me all the time, what are we going to do about these pensions? And I think it's pretty clear you have to do what the state Supreme Court said. You got to pay them.
Well, the action or the decision by the state Supreme Court a couple of years ago regarding the pension bill that was passed puts up a constitutional barrier that at some point we need to look at. Can we address it or not? But in the meantime, we have to make the pension payments. And the governor made, the correct decision with the money that came in April to say, okay, we're going to make our pension payment in full for this year. That doesn't eliminate the other structural issues that we have in financially within the state of Illinois, and that's why his proposal is so important.
We're talking to General David Harris. He's director of the Illinois Department of Revenue. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson, the Chicago Tribune, here in the Allstate Skyline studio, joined by General David Harris. He's the director of the Illinois Department of Revenue. General, as I've been saying all morning, having gone to Springfield, May 31st, scheduled adjournment date of the General Assembly, with a number of major issues still unresolved. And I mentioned cannabis legalization, sports betting as revenue issues. Obviously, sports betting is a revenue issue. Cannabis, not as obviously people say, it's not the stated purposes to get revenue, but it encompasses a host of things. Both of these issues are I think, much more complicated than maybe, shall I say, the governor might have thought going in when he talked about him on the campaign trail?
Oh, I don't know that the governor necessarily didn't understand the difficulty of moving any of these and the complications of dealing with the legislature and working with the legislature, which he has said all along that it's a negotiation process. And there are 3 weeks left legislative term. 3 weeks is almost an eternity. But keep in mind that there have been a lot of working groups on, as an example, adult use marijuana, on sports betting. They've been working kind of behind the scenes for quite some time now. Now bills have been introduced in the legislature, and we get full legislative participation, and the governor will continue to negotiate with the legislature on this.
And actually, I think there's almost like a function two key in the governor's office, because anytime one of these language of legislation surfaces, it's we look forward to working with the shareholders and negotiate with the legislature. I'm not making fun of that, but that I tend to think of the legislation now, and I mentioned this earlier, rather than legislation as an iteration of these various things.
And I think that's a fair way to say it. It is an iteration. It moves forward. You put the proposals out there. You get response back from the stakeholders, and it moves in an iterative process. But that's why democracy is so great. The governor has proposed a responsible approach to these things. The Senate is going to look at it. They've done what they want to do in certain areas. Now it's going to go over to the House, and that's what negotiation is all about. And clearly the governor wants to and is willing to participate in that process.
Well, and certainly one of the top campaign issues that he campaigned on was the issue of moving Illinois from its flat rate income tax to a graduated rate income tax based on growth in income, similar to the federal system. That proposal to change the Constitution has passed the Senate
still awaiting a vote in the House. That would go before voters for ratification if it passes the House on the 2020 November ballot. That's why you were speaking of this bridge to stability, was right, because there's the assumption that if it got on the ballot, it would pass, although it'd be a very contested ballot issue. But I think, you know, we're seeing in the House still, you know, some concerns from lawmakers, concerns from some Democrats. A couple of them have said they want more negotiations over things like more relief from property taxes. You certainly, from Arlington Heights and your time in the legislature, know the concerns about property taxes. I'm not sure where the House goes on this. There are not a lot of numbers that Speaker Madigan has for people to freelance off this.
Well, I'm not going to predict what happens in the House, although I do believe that that the proposal will pass, the constitutional amendment will pass. How the votes come together still remains to be seen. No question that property taxes are an issue and have always been an issue, one of the biggest issues in the state of Illinois. The governor proposed a 20% increase in the tax credit for property taxes. The House may come up and say, well, we want something a little bit different. All part of the negotiation process, going back and forth with how we move this forward. So we will see where it develops.
Well, and to me, and I mean, obviously, you're director of the State Department of Revenue, and I think there, people still have a misconception that the state gets some of that property tax money.
they do, and we don't.
but I mean, I do get the sense that if there's a great deal of unrest about people complaining about taxes and we're overtaxed and whatever, it all goes to the property tax.
Oh, I honestly believe that the property tax is one of the toughest nuts to break through in terms of reform of the property tax and how we handle that issue. And the property tax...
Reform of taxation?
Well, reform of specifically property tax, because the property tax is probably one of the thorniest issues we have to deal with in Illinois. In terms of income taxes and other taxes... We're right in the middle, whether it's a flat tax or the fair tax. We're right in the middle with everyone else. With the fair tax, 97% of the people in Illinois will not see any tax increase whatsoever. Wisconsin actually has a higher progressive rate than we do. So when you look at the property tax, though, to try to get some property tax relief, which was what the governor has done in his proposal with a 20% increase on the credit, it is an important issue.
Well, and we've seen, I think, in the Senate, which also not only approved the constitutional amendment proposal, but also attached to a three-bill package of proposed tax rates, as well as a proposed property tax freeze on school districts if certain conditions are met. But those conditions, I mean, yes, everything is conditional, but there's a lot of work to meet those conditions.
There is a lot of work to meet the conditions, and I'm not, I concentrate on the revenue end of it rather than the policy end of it, specifically related to those sorts of things. So that will have to be worked out, again, between the Senate and the House as to whether or not the House goes along with what the Senate passes. And then, of course, you need to get the governor's signature on anything that might be passed by the legislature.
Except for the proposed constitutional amendment.
Except for the constitutional amendment, correct. If the House passes that, it will go directly to the voters and the governor has to take no action, correct.
A lot still to be done in Springfield, as always.
3 weeks is an eternity in legislative time.
I'm going to remind you of that next time I see you in June.
Okay, that's fine.
That's David Harris, General David Harris, Director of the Illinois Department of Revenue. General, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Good to be with you. Thank you.